under the prohibition against the use of fire, and using electronics of any sort which demands a completed circuit and is a violation of the principle of joining two things together. This last prohibition effectively renders all cell phones, computers, and televisions completely off limits during the 25 hours of the Sabbath. I was recently involved in a creativity symposium in San Francisco. Among the speakers was Bill Wozniak, former senior editor at Wired magazine. Before the event, Bill and I had a chance to speak about the idea of stepping back from technology and how the rituals of Shabbat echoed a very important, if often missing, dimension of technology itself, our ability to shut it off. Not just to shut it off once a year or for a few moments throughout a day, but by a regular, systematized means. Bill observed that this ritual pointed not to some ancient and irrelevant past, but to a decidedly postmodern view of our integration with technology. During my workshops, I almost always have participants write the smartphone letter, brain bottle opener number 5. As recently as 2 years ago, I had to ask that people bring their phones to the workshops. Today, that suggestion is as absurd as asking them to bring their livers. And while I strongly believe that as a tool, it is perhaps the most miraculous thing ever created on the planet, I'm also cognizant of the smartphone having made us into actual cyborgs, human beings whose abilities have been enhanced by technology. The very real danger is that as we progress deeper and deeper into the offerings of technology, many of us, perhaps most of us, will be completely cut off to the experience of ever living without the technology. What's the problem, you ask, with using the cyborg advantage in the first place? A host of reasons come to mind. Losing touch with simple human experiences such as conversation, solitude, reflection, intimacy, and feeling the awesomeness of nature, but mostly it involves the cost. I'm not talking about the purchase price of our devices. I'm talking about the fact that every communication-related technology seems to also be a platform and driver of advertising, and nearly every ad tells us that we are not good enough. With a steady diet of messaging that exists to explain how we're not complete people unless we do or buy or become X, it's no wonder we've lost touch with our creative spirit. Each time we use a search engine, listen to Spotify, or watch a video on YouTube, we are being sold something. And 99.999% of the time, it's nothing we need or even want. Marketers are watching us through our every keystroke and gaining a keener understanding not only of what we aspire toward, but also ominously what we fear. Taking time away from ideas and influences that tell us only about our shortcomings is partly how we avoid becoming stuck thinkers. Doing so requires a strategy, a methodology to counter the sway of the multi-billion-dollar industries which exist in part to disable us, to mollify and flatten us, so that in the end we become susceptible to whatever advertisers want to sell us. I'm by no means a Luddite or a conspiracy theorist. I'm just aware that there are natural economic forces that work by their own rules and contain their own power. Power we must endeavor to understand if we want to manifest our personal dreams. We will be better prepared to understand this power and how we can effectively integrate it into our lives if we can find ways to disconnect from technology on a regular basis. The work comes primarily from becoming mindful about technology's encroachment into your own life and the lives of your family and friends. To be mindful requires that you step back, draw a deep breath, and then take an objective look at where you stand in relation to this ever-expanding force in your life. Brain Bottle Opener 15. Disconnect to reconnect. Allow 2 minutes to pick one day this week, for a 4-hour technological fast, not including times when you'd normally be asleep. During this 4-hour digital technological fast, you will not use telephone or smartphone, electric lights, email, computer, radio, record player, car, cigarette lighter, amplified instrument, camera, microwave oven, electric can opener, in short, pretty much any technology that was invented after the mid-1700s. See how 4 hours feels. If it's too much, reduce the time. If it feels like you can do more, go for it. The trick is to make this a regular part of your weekly rhythm, to get this technological fast as fully integrated into your life as possible so that there's more time for things that don't cost much. Meals together, love, communication, bonding, real memory creation with the people you're closest to. Real-world applications. This BBO isn't an exercise per se. It's a way of life. Imagine you're an elementary school teacher and you're tasked with having to create a new lesson plan every evening for your next day's class. Doing this BBO at least once a week will give you a window into the many creative ideas latent in your mind. These thoughts may well have been inspired by things you've seen on TV or on the internet. I'm not saying our new technologies aren't a fantastic source for creativity, but going on regular technological fasts will give you a chance to assimilate and incorporate your ideas. You can't have information feeding in constantly. In order to generate ideas, the stream of information intake ultimately needs to be suspended. Allowing space in your mind for new and proactive ideas to take root has the added benefit of combating negative thinking. Your negative assumptions will no longer have free rein. They'll have to compete with your positive thoughts for a change. A particularly good time to do this BBO is when you feel so harried that disconnecting from technology feels impossible. That may be a sign that it's a propitious time to do so. Chapter 16 of Posses and Puzzles. How a support system can make the difference between a dream pursued and a dream abandoned. Your posse is a collective of any size. It could be just one other person that can serve as a sounding board, a guardrail, or a cheerleading section to keep your dream on track. It's particularly helpful when your enthusiasm for your goal is waning. Surrounding yourself with supportive people is key, and if you don't already have a group of friends you can call on to form your posse, you can get started in almost any city in the world by searching the internet. If you like to knit, you can find a knitting group nearby, you can find classical music groups, writers' workshops, woodworking groups, skydiving communities, and filmmaking collectives. Creative people are clamoring to meet with other people with similar interests and synergize their ideas. While the idea of having someone in your corner is hardly new, I find that in nearly every case in which a person finds the challenge of bringing her ideas to life to be too great, she's neglected to take this simple step. There are no cases that I've ever seen in which someone was able to fully develop her ideas without some sort of help from another person. A puzzle solved. The last person we're going to hear from is Debbie Gold, an exceptionally fearless innovator and someone who benefited enormously from the feedback and support she received from her posse. Debbie was a tour manager with rock acts ranging from the Grateful Dead to Bob Dylan. After years of work on the road, she created a job for herself that had never existed. She became the first person to act as an agent, not for rock acts themselves, but for sound engineers and producers. I met her when I was working with my good friend, the late producer-engineer Don Smith, who was responsible for hits with acts like Tom Petty, U2, and the Rolling Stones. As the music business continued to fall into its current state of disruption, Debbie knew that she had to reinvent herself yet again. She came up with something totally unexpected, but still within the range of her specialized skill set, Her idea was simple, definitely of the why didn't I think of that variety? Well, we didn't and she did. She created a best-selling line of jigsaw puzzles using the LP covers of famous music acts, Jimi Hendrix, Johnny Cash, The Grateful Dead, and others, called Rediscover Jigsaw Puzzles. It was an elegant and simple idea. Just as Debbie unearthed the hidden value of seemingly useless and outmoded objects such as vinyl LP covers, she found the hidden value in her own experiences and her many supporters. One person in particular helped with encouragement, ideas, and constructive critiques along the path to making Debbie's goals become reality. Sure, Debbie's idea was simple, but think about how painstaking it must have been for her to see the idea through to the finish. Licensing agreements, intellectual property rights issues, dealing with estates, lawyers, you name it. Here's how she did it, and how her posse was integral to her success. To Debbie, it seemed so unusual that she'd come up with a puzzle. That was about the last thing she ever thought she'd do. But as she looked back at all the different things she'd done in her career, road managing acts, representing producers, putting bands together like a casting agent, and all the novel things she did over the years, it started to make sense. In her words, I'm an idea person. I asked Debbie what she felt being an idea person entails. I've done things that have literally never been done before, she said. I knew that David Geffen was looking for a producer for a band of his. I just made it happen, and then I realized, wait a minute, I think this is a great idea to have producers be represented by an agent. It was the first time it was ever done, and then people chased after me to do it for them. I literally made that up. The point of this is that you have to be brave. Experience has taught us all that there's always somebody who's going to haul off and criticize a novel idea. And I wondered what Debbie's particular strategies were for dealing with the naysayers. How did she cope with the emotional blows? First off, she told me, you always run the risk of somebody not taking you seriously or not listening to you. So I think it's really about following your instincts and knowing that you can have a voice. When I'm afraid, I often think, if this is so good, why hasn't anybody done it before? How many of us also come up with great ideas like Debbie's, perhaps as we're lying in bed, ideas that we totally dismiss by the time we're dressed and out the door in the morning? One of the ways Debbie was able to sustain her idea was using the impetus she got from her posse when she brought her nascent puzzle concept to her friend Bob Weir, the guitarist for the Grateful Dead. After getting great initial feedback from him, she would meet with Weir periodically to talk through her ideas as they continued to develop. Weir gave her the support she needed, along with clear strategies to bring her idea to fruition. She told me, the day I actually held the first finished puzzle in my hand was magical. It gave me a profound sense of the power of my own imagination. I know that Debbie is well aware that from time to time, we all get notions about the way we'd like things to be. But she also knows that most people can't follow through on those fleeting visions. As we concluded our discussion, she put down the puzzle pieces she'd been holding and thought for a moment before saying, I think the act of following through is a lot about undoing the negativity we've learned over the years. When you're a little kid, you believe you're smart and that you have great instincts. You do creative things like talk to invisible people. You believe in all kinds of stuff. Then you're taught, oh, grow up. Don't be immature. Don't be this. Don't be that. I think that you have to unlearn some of this. It's mostly about trusting yourself and then surrounding yourself with trusted people who can support your ideas. Form your personal posse. Just after I lost my job on Bones, I began meeting with my own personal posse to help get over feeling like the biggest loser in the world. This posse consists of about 10 trusted friends, all successful people who often feel that their best creative years are behind them. To say aloud that you feel a little lost or a little old or a little worthless is hard for people to do. We need our spouses, our friends, our kids, our clients, our parents, and our bosses to keep on believing that we've got everything under control. Oftentimes, we get so good at purveying the control myth that we start believing our own fiction. And of course, that's precisely where the trouble starts. To protect ourselves, we begin by deluding the people around us. And then without noticing, we begin to delude ourselves. At that point, we've become so lost, we don't even know we're lost. My posse provides enormous help to those of us who feel a little marginalized, a little left behind in a world in which being over 30 is something to be worn like a scarlet letter. We serve as one another's personal board members, listening mostly, giving some advice, and listening some more. I know it sounds a bit odd and maybe even indulgent to say this given all the trouble facing the world, but the struggles we have are far from small. We've all got families to support, people who depend on us to keep our confidence up and our creative juices flowing. The posse is how we help to keep each other in the very condition most of us never thought we'd be in again, highly energized, impassioned, and inspired. The other thing we do is encourage one another to take risks. Simple things such as learning to dance, in my case. My wife, and to be fair, many others have remarked that I am literally the worst dancer they've ever seen. In spite of that, I took a tango class recently, and for the first time I saw how I could become, with a great deal of practice, something slightly less than a total embarrassment to my species. But the truth is, at my age, I don't really mind looking like a fool once in a while. Not avoiding embarrassment is the whole point. It's the way we developed our skills in the first place. No kid ever picks up a guitar or hits a speed bag or goes in for a layup perfectly the first few times. It's just that when we're young, it's expected that we won't be perfect. Somewhere along the way, after receiving a certain number of accolades, we lose touch with the beauty, the poignancy of making mistakes. That's what the posse does best. It helps people relearn how to be comfortable with making mistakes. And through those mistakes, and particularly the freedom from the fear of not appearing to be perfect, we are made joyful again. The joy comes from the renewal of possibility. When you have that, you get this wonderfully elusive and very human feeling called hope. And I ask you, is there a greater joy than having a reinvigorated sense of hope? Here's how to get started. Call a friend and ask for advice. Everyone likes to dole it out, and it's a great way to break the ice and elevate the tenor of your conversations. Start a dialogue that goes beyond talking about the weather, or worse, having a non-conversation that's merely a rehashing of that endless laundry list of complaints. Talk about rebirth. Talk about getting outside yourself and doing things for other people. Talk about the things you loved and dreamed about as a kid, and about real practical ways you can start doing those things again today. If you're still wondering why a posse is crucial for bringing your ideas to fruition, consider this. The Posse Foundation, a national organization dedicated to helping public high school students get into college, has been instrumental in giving a leg up to students lacking the resources available to wealthier families. Since 1989, these Posse scholars, many of whom are from urban centers and might have been overlooked by traditional college selection processes, have been receiving four-year full-tuition leadership scholarships. The Posse Foundation's remarkable success rate in producing college graduates is 90%. In major American cities, the graduation rate for students outside the Posse Foundation's program can be as low as 10%. Much of the foundation's work is done through a one-on-one mentorship program, which helps keep the students inspired and accountable. External deflators, negativity from without. While it's true that posses are essential for helping you bring your ideas into the world, you need to be careful about who you share your goals with, especially in the early stages. because they're still underdeveloped. These nascent ideas are fragile like gossamer and especially susceptible to discouragement. Marv is ready to pounce on them, for sure. And if someone from the outside gets in there and digs a hole into your early stage dream, Marv might just be able to finish it off. Here's a letter a fan wrote to me with this very problem. Peter, I've recently finished an early draft of a book of poetry, and though I've been excited and confident about it for the most part, I found my enthusiasm wane dramatically after showing it to a friend and getting a lukewarm response. Laura H. My response. Dear Laura, I really wish I could have shared what I'm going to say to you before you let your friend read the manuscript. But since you already have, consider it, as my Grandma Rose used to say in Yiddish, beschert, meant to be. Here's the cold truth about friendships. Oftentimes, people whom we consider to be our good friends may be harshly critical of things we are passionate about. I call these people external deflators or EDs. ED's negative tendencies, just like Marv's team of internal deflators, make ideas that haven't had a chance to fully form extremely susceptible to negative feedback. EDs are functionally fixed, and as such, they're bringing stuck thinking to the table when they should be bringing kid thinking. I think of my own work in its early stages as tender shoots that can be easily uprooted and destroyed. Knowing this, I'm always very judicious about who I'll let see early drafts of things I create. I'm not looking for people to fawn over the ideas at this early stage, but I am looking for guidance and support. As such, I'm selective in presenting these early iterations only to people who are familiar with the process of inventing things, people who through their own experience with innovation are knowledgeable and sensitive about the delicate nature of early work. I'm not only lucky to have such people in my life, I've actively sought them out over the years as kindred spirits, and I've cultivated friendships based on the knowledge that we offer one another support, inspiration, and guidance, as opposed to so-called constructive criticism, which in many cases feels like a thinly veiled means of throwing cold water on a project. I'm not a cynic. I believe most people's motives are good. It's just that EDs are not empathetic, so they fail to realize the damage they're causing. They don't try to problem solve what an innovator does. They problem identify and think the idea lacks merit because of the problem's existence. All creation is a process of creating order and solutions out of chaos and problems. It's a process of motion, going from one place to another. Saying something is bad completely disregards how close to great it might actually be. So, Laura, it's impossible for me to determine just how your friend's comments are intended and what your level of sensitivity to the comments might actually be, though my suspicion is aroused whenever I see someone go away deflated as opposed to strengthened after an encounter. The questions to ask yourself are these. Were you uplifted by the conversation with your friend, even if it included advice and opinions that might differ from your own, or were you made to feel humiliated and that your aspirations had no merit? It's vital that you take your creative ideas into the world, yet you must always exercise the appropriate caution in not bringing things that are still in process to an external deflator. Brain Bottle Opener 16, Support List. First, take 2 minutes to create a list of people you feel will be supportive in your quest to make your dream real. Then take another 5 minutes to email at least one of those people to schedule a time to meet. Be prepared to ask to meet with that person either face-to-face or by phone at least 3 times in the next 90 days. Remember, the purpose of your posse is to provide reaffirming support as you unleash your big muse, but it's surprising how many people forget this important step. At a minimum, that person from your list is your support team. He or she is not the manager of your dreams or your gatekeeper. You alone must provide the overall direction. Incidentally, if you can't think of anyone who can serve as your posse member, use the time in this BBO to make a list of local workshops, collectives, and interest groups that you can call on to develop your posse and work from there. Finally, keep your list of names or the workshop resources and your meeting schedule on a wall where you can see it every day. If for some reason you find yourself feeling like you need a bigger posse before you can move forward, that's Marv talking. One good human being is all you'll need. Real-world applications. Let's say you're switching careers, for instance, going from stock market trader to certified financial planner. Even though they are related fields, there are challenging certification exams to be taken and passed, new skills to be mastered, and a new crop of clients to be found. The differences between these two jobs are apparent enough to create a great deal of anxiety. Having a list of friends, colleagues, or teachers whom you know for certain you can call upon to discuss your apprehensions and ideas can be a powerful motivator as you move forward. Having a concrete schedule of when you will be in touch takes this feeling of control one step further. The list and the schedule are just paper after all. They won't talk to you or take you out dancing, but you will feel encouraged and embraced in very real ways by seeing the names on the list and knowing the precise times you will be in touch with your posse. Chapter 17, Fusing Form and Structure. How to Stay Singing Through Rough Weather. Aviation navigation is a continual process of course correction. Most people don't realize that 95% of the time, any given plane in the sky is being thrown off course by wind, weather, and other factors. One of the pilot's main jobs is making constant small navigational adjustments. Similarly, someone who's successfully pursuing a goal will spend much of his or her time just trying to stay on track. Successful dreammakers act like these pilots. They are comfortable with the idea that course correction is a natural part of dream catching. They know that there is no such thing as a perfectly straight line connecting them from point A to point B. They also know that having strategies in place to keep their goals on track is essential for getting them where they need to go. Throughout the book, I've outlined numerous tactics you can use, not only for getting started, but also for staying on your path. Lists of the people who will remain supportive, reminders about the ways your life can change for the better when you follow through on your ideas, strategies to help you disconnect from distracting people and media, even writing a letter to yourself to remind you of the things you need to let go of before you can move ahead. All the techniques we've looked at in the book create harbors of safety for when the inevitable storm winds blow and threaten to throw your dream off course. This last brain bottle opener is something I use in all my Big Muse workshops. In fact, it's the culmination of all the previous BBOs. For those of you who are already songwriters, this next bit of instruction will be one more tool to use in your creative arsenal. For those of you who've never written a song, this will be your chance to create a cogent, creative statement that can serve as the theme song of your personal dream. It will help to keep you focused and on point. If you have no interest in writing a song and are perhaps saying, "I want to spend my valuable time developing my own ideas," let me be clear, I hear you. The reason I'm asking you to create a song in the first place is because it will powerfully assist you in visualizing your own particular dream, making you that much better prepared to establish it in the real world. Engagement with music and songs on any level, writing them, listening to them, playing them, dancing to them, and singing them, has the additional benefit of allowing information of all types to stay fresh in the mind and the memory. Dr. Henry L. Roediger III, an expert in the study of memory retrieval, and a professor of psychology at the Washington University in St. Louis Memory Lab, explains, "Our brains have what amount to two hulking mainframe computers, the hippocampus and the frontal cortex. They are the two areas most associated with memory and they are capable of processing millions of bits of information daily. Dr. Rudiger says that from a neurological perspective, getting information into those areas isn't the tricky part. The challenge we face is pulling that data back out. Music, he says, provides a rhythm and a rhyme, and occasionally an alliteration in the lyric. All of this is what makes a song helpful in information retrieval. If we were asked to recite all the words to a Beatles song, Dr. Rudiger says, we couldn't do it unless we sang it in our minds. Music is a natural cueing device, but it's the song's structure that allows a person to get at the information it holds. Music is a powerful repetition engine. It's not necessarily the song's melody, but the overall formal structure, along with the melody, that promotes the repetition, which is what promotes memorization. That's why patients in advanced stages of Alzheimer's have been known to sing along to familiar songs. Dr. Rudiger also says that neuroscientists believe humans develop music and dance to aid in the retrieval of information. The idea was that the chant would help people to remember large sets of information across the ages. As you begin the process of writing your song, don't worry at all if you're not a musician. The most difficult part of writing a song for most people, songwriters included, is often the lyrics, which anyone can write, and that's what we're going to deal with now. Here are the simple steps to creating your very own lyrical mission statement. Brain Bottle Opener 17. Write your song. Following the instructions listed in this BBO, you will write song lyrics that contain the essence of one of your dreams. Think of it as your own personal theme song. It will consist of three verses of four lines each. When you're done, you'll have written 12 lines. Hang up a copy of your finished song on your refrigerator or your bathroom wall and sign your name to it following this format. 30 Crates of Kale. Copyright 2016 by Susan T. Everywoman. This little detail can give you a stronger relationship to your song. Then, if you're musical, you can always write a melody for it. If not, find a guitar or piano teacher from a local music store and ask him or her to help you with a melody. Make sure to send the lyrics or an MP3 of the song to a friend. Putting it out into the world changes you, and it just might change the world. Are you ready to start? Think of everything we've covered so far. You can do this. Remember, tiny, specific steps. Start by preparing. Gather information. Go to a quiet place and give yourself 3 minutes to concentrate on the dream you want to pursue, that dream you thought about or wrote down at the beginning of the book or listed in the 2-minute drill. The first step is to picture as much as you can about the physical experience of seeing your dream made manifest. Imagine yourself in the midst of pursuing your dream. Envision yourself in that place, working on that goal. Use your future vision to see it vividly as it comes into focus. Make a sensory list. Now, give yourself 2.5 minutes to kid think and write down the sensations you're imagining, the sights, smells, sounds, touch. Where are you? Precisely what are you experiencing as you go about making your dream come true? Go for the minutia. Consider nothing too insignificant. The smaller the detail, the better. For example, someone who has a dream of becoming a photographer might visualize herself shooting a high school football practice in late fall in northern Minnesota. The list she creates might look something like this. Cold wind on a November afternoon. Crows cawing. Bonfire burning. Freezing fingers. A train rumbling in the distance. The sound of young men yelling, grunting, shoulder pads and helmets colliding, cleats making rhythm on the frozen ground. An old man walking a dog, a goalpost against a steel-gray sky, an early sunset, breath coming out as steam, a muddy field. Notice that there is no meaning associated with these images. They're simply observations and sense perceptions. Think of them as the opening to a movie that's playing in your mind. The credits are rolling, there's music and sounds, but there is no story yet, just a series of pictures. The camera pans from left to right, and the images place you in the scene. Make a list of emotional insights. The next step in gathering information is to create a list of the emotions that are associated with bringing your dream into existence. Give yourself 2.5 minutes to jot down the feelings you get as you see your goal coming closer. How are you different? What is your emotional reaction to finally seeing your dream leave your head and manifest itself in the real world? Here are some examples of emotional insights that our hypothetical photographer might use. I feel awake to possibilities. I can't wait to submit these pictures to the Brainerd Dispatch. I feel alive. It feels good to be here. As the sun is going down, the pictures are becoming more dramatic. I feel engaged, hopeful. I want to buy the Sony A99. It's an amazing camera. I am happy to be here. I'm not worrying about anything. I can't wait to send these pictures to Dave. I'm just trying to get the images to look their best. I feel free. The world looks beautiful to me now. A note on structure. Next, after you've made your two lists, it's time to turn your sensory list and the emotional insights list into a song. The first thing to learn about songwriting is that, just like everything else in life, songs need a structure to stand on. There are an unlimited number of structures that you could use for your song. Some have verses that don't rhyme, and some have complicated bridges and odd time signatures. But for now, I want you to use one song structure in particular. The following song is something I just made up off the top of my head, so don't judge me too harshly. I wrote it to illustrate a well-known, very simple structure, which is especially useful for first-time songwriters. More advanced songwriters will recognize it as a forcing frame that can be used to create a compact and elegant song as well. Stay with this exact structure. It's an easy-to-work-with, time-tested classic. Check out the title in the first verse. Black Winged Bird. Line 1. She's gone and left me out in the cold. Line 2. Don't know how much pain my poor heart can hold. Line 3. She took off her Lubbock without saying a word. Line 4. Flew out of my life like a black-winged bird. If you look at the preceding verse, you'll see a few obvious things. First is that the title ends with a simple word that is both evocative and easy to rhyme with: bird. Word, heard, third, blurred, curd, stirred, nerd, absurd. Second is that the first two lines rhyme with each other, as do the last two. The final thing to be aware of is that in this particular song structure, the fourth line always ends with the title, in this case, Black Winged Bird. Songwriting steps. 1. Choose a title. First, take 1 minute to choose a title from either your sensory list or your emotional insights list. Look for something that appeals to you, but make sure it's easy to rhyme with. In this particular song structure, You don't want to use a title like The Garrulous Crustacean Antecedents. It's going to be too hard to find rhymes for a title like that, though it might make a cool band name. I'm going to choose a line to use as a title directly for my hypothetical photographer's sensory list. Cleats making rhythm on the frozen ground. I'll shorten it to Rhythm on the Frozen Ground. I didn't spend too much time deciding on that title. I just like the sound of it, and the word ground rhymes easily. Now, before you actually start writing or running for the hills, let's walk through the process of creating each line. 2. Create a first line. Simply pick one of the phrases from your lists. Select it deliberately or randomly. It doesn't really matter. Just pick something that moves you. I'm going to go with cold wind on a November afternoon. Reading back that phrase, I can see in my mind's eye what that football field looks like and feels like. I take off my gloves and I can feel that wind on my fingers as I shoot the pictures. 3. Create a second line. Compose a second line that resonates with your feelings about seeing your dream come true, or simply pick another phrase from either list. The only requirement is that it rhymes with your first line. In this example, cold wind on a November afternoon. And don't be afraid to use a rhyming dictionary. They're available for free all over the internet. How's this? Cold wind on a November afternoon. I feel alive. My dream is coming soon. 4. Create a third line. Next, write a third line in that same vein, making sure that the last word of the line rhymes with the last word of the title you've chosen, which will finish your fourth line, Rhythm on Frozen Ground in my case. So my finished first verse sounds like this. Cold wind on a November afternoon. I feel alive. My dream is coming soon. I'm capturing the world and the sun is going down as cleats make rhythm on frozen ground. Now, make one more verse of four lines using the same technique. I'll try the following lines for my second verse. Still choosing many of them directly from either my sensory or emotional list. I'm happy to be here, not worrying about a thing. The crows caw as my heart begins to sing. I'm hopeful at last as I hear the sound of cleats making rhythm on frozen ground. Now let's write one more four-line verse. I feel awake to possibility as a bonfire's burning. It started coming in clear just as I started yearning. This dream of mine's a miracle I found as cleats make rhythm on frozen ground. It's time to write your three verses, each made up of four lines, with your title as the last part of your fourth line. Remember to use your sensory and emotional lists for inspiration and stay within the set structure. Try not to overthink and don't worry about having to make literal or linear sense. Many of the songs we love most, be they Strawberry Fields Forever, Wichita Lineman, or Tangled Up in Blue, almost never make literal sense. They do, however, all evoke strong feelings. Sacrificing literal meaning for emotional heft is often what makes a song resonate. The title of my hypothetical photographer's song, Rhythm on Frozen Ground, doesn't need to mean anything. The image it conveys, especially in the context of the photographer's dream, is powerful in and of itself. Notice that the lines I've used from this song have been almost exclusively pulled from the sensory list and the list of emotional insights. Except for tweaking a few phrases to make them rhyme, it was as if the work of writing the song had already been done for me. This happened because I could see and feel myself in that hypothetical scenario up in northern Minnesota in my mind's eye. Occasionally, songwriting should and can feel effortless. Final step, your turn. Now, go to a quiet place and give yourself 10 minutes to write and finish your song. Don't worry that it isn't enough time, because it is. You can always come back and polish it later. For now, I want you to feel the urgency of the time limits I'm giving you. Trust me, the limits are a good thing. This is the moment to kid think without thoughts of external reward. Look for the immersive motivator. If you feel lost, go back and listen to the sample song I wrote. What I'm going to say now might sound odd, but it's important. Get comfortable with the idea of writing something that is pure crap. Yeah, pure, unadulterated crap. Just finish it. That's the goal, the finish, not the genius. Again, be comfortable with writing something horrible. I'm serious. There's a metaphor I use occasionally that's perfect, and you know by now I'm fond of metaphors. I'm a songwriter, after all. But I hesitate to use it because it's, well, less than dignified. But here goes. You should treat the products of your imagination exactly as you treat your own bowel movements. They're just something that happens. No sane person is offended by or afraid of his or her own waste. That would be weird. And it's just as weird to be offended by or afraid of the products of your own imagination, whether they're brilliant or worthless. The harsh judgment is what kills the creative process. It's just like those karate guys, the 1 out of 300 I talked about in Chapter 6, who weren't afraid of getting hit. Don't let your fear of being bad prevent you from accomplishing the goal of simply following the form I've given you and finishing your song. This kind of unabashed kid thinking will help you dive into your Milky Way moment. Just write. If you need to use a rhyming dictionary, go for it. If you need a thesaurus, there are great ones on the internet. Books, magazines, dictionaries, anything that helps is fair game. Think less and write more. I'll say it twice more for you. Think less, write more. Think less, write more. At some point, you need to simply give way to doing. That point is now. Real-world applications. Aside from the fact that I'm a professional songwriter, there are a couple of reasons the Write Your Song BBO is a central metaphor in my Big Muse seminars. First, songs are short. They're not screenplays, novels, or symphonies. As such, they can be created in a relatively short time. The other reason is that a song is a beautiful metaphor for creativity itself. It is by its very nature highly structured, so much so that its form can often seem constraining. Consider the song structure analogous to left-brain thinking. On the other hand, the rigid structure needs to be filled with connective, original, utterly human and emotional thought. Think of that aspect of a song as analogous to right-brain thinking. The extent to which you are successful in creating that emotional connectivity within your structure will determine the power of your song. In this sense, a well-crafted song is the perfect fusion of both left and right-brain thought processes. In terms of practicality, this BBO is the mother lode. I won't even deign to list its potential applications. Suffice it to say that there is nothing you can create, no dream that you can fulfill, that doesn't contain these two opposites, structure and form, in equal measure. Part 5 Review. Here we are, at the conclusion of the book. Let's take one final look at where we are and what we've covered in this last section. By doing the Disconnect to Reconnect BBO, you committed to a 4-hour technological fast one day this week, during which you abstained from using any modern technology. The quietude of technological disconnection enables you to reconnect with your natural focus and energy. In the din and confusion of your life, it's going to be reassuring to know that you have a means of shutting down the things that distract you from achieving your dream. You created a posse you believe will support you on your quest to make your vision a reality. The list is just paper and ink, of course, but the names you wrote symbolize an inestimable source of encouragement. Knowing that you can call on your support system and actually doing so will keep you on track whenever you falter. And finally, you wrote the lyrics to a song. Consider it your personal dream theme song. Having it handy to recite or sing will help keep your vision clear and alive. I talked a lot about vision throughout this book, creating a picture of the way things ought to be, the way they could be. Vision doesn't come only from the things we can see. The vision I'm referring to, the future vision, is more like an accumulation of evidence. It's a step-by-step process. At some point, probably without you ever even being aware, there will come an intuitive understanding that will lead you to know that this thing you desire, this dream of yours, is far more real than you could have ever imagined. Putting it all together, it's time to wrap things up. Here's a condensed look at the various ways you have now learned to let out your big muse. You'll recall that your big muse is your instinctual capacity for creativity. We're each gifted with it. Remember that when I say creativity, I don't necessarily mean in terms of art or music or any of the things we normally associate with the word, so don't be confused. It's your creative spirit I'm talking about, your native creative energy. And if your dream is not materializing, it's because your big muse is bottled up. You need to let it out, but it can't come out until your fear of embarrassment or disappointment is outweighed by your desire to see your dream made manifest. When your need to create is just that much greater than your fear, you become a kid thinker. A kid thinker is able to react fearlessly without mar of that negative voice inside your head constantly telling you you're not good enough, not pretty enough, or not smart enough. Remember that even though Marv is annoying, his goal isn't to make your life miserable. All he's trying to do is spare you from failure, which in his paranoid thinking leads to shame and then to abandonment. Marv has been with you forever. He was there to protect you when you were young. And when he's truly intent on saving you from change, he reminds you, if you do something stupid, you will feel shame. Shame will lead you to abandonment. And bong, the bell of doom tolls. Abandonment means death. Fear is why you're afraid to express your vulnerability. And vulnerability is nothing more than openness to the challenges new ideas present. That's why vulnerability under the appropriate circumstances is such a big driver of the creative process. Your future vision is your highly detailed image of your fulfilled life. Marv will prevent you from seeing it as long as you're not actually doing anything to make it happen. Once you start the careful process of clarifying your future vision, you'll have less imposition from Marv. To prevent you from unleashing your big muse, Marv enlists the services of the deflators. They're nothing more than the details of your own imagination turned against you and your dreams. The deflators will bind you with elephant ropes, your painful memories, which keep you bound to a vulnerable past. When you're transfixed by these memories, you become too afraid to pursue your dream. In this state, you can easily become trapped by a logjam, a depression that will leave you utterly stuck. You can break the logjam by writing a letting go letter, which is a tool that helps you determine what you need to get rid of in your life. The letting go letter examines the people, things, or beliefs you need to cut out of your life before you can move forward again. Clearing that emotional space will help reignite an extinguished future vision. When Marv and his deflators have you trapped, you cease to be a kid thinker. Instead, you become a stuck thinker. There are two kinds of stuck thinkers, blockheads and idea bunnies. A blockhead is someone who's so convinced by what Marv says that he doesn't even know what he dreams of doing. Idea bunnies have another problem altogether. They have so many ideas that they neglect to act on any of them. To make your dream a reality, you need both goals and actions that are specific, present, and true. It works like this. 1. Break your goal into specific, doable parts. 2. Take action on those parts immediately. 3. Ascertain that the goal you've chosen is truly something you desire, not something you're doing to please someone else. After taking the small, specific steps towards making your dream a reality, you enter a state called the Milky Way moment, the joyful experience of finally going from the anxiety-filled mulling to the joyous doing. Getting down to the business of making dreams happen is its own reward. With a little luck, as you're hyper-engaged in the details of making your dreams real, you may pass from the Milky Way moment to the hourglass, a blissful state of creative thinking in which hours go by like minutes. But if you're stuck listening to Marv without taking any other action except to listen to him and his pessimism, he compensates you with the dried blade of grass, his dull, dry, tasteless, nutritionless consolation prize for your obeisance to his negativity. Next, use your Milky Way GPS to recalibrate the trajectory of your dreams when they invariably go off course. Your Milky Way GPS consists of the following. 1. Enlisting a posse of supporters to guide you. 2. Doing regular technological fasts to free your mind. 3. Avoiding external deflators who will always tell you why you won't succeed. 4. Doing the Write Your Song BBO, which is a way to take your dream and make it manifest in song form. While not actually taking shape in the real sense, your dream will have become far clearer now that you've placed it within a rhythmic and rhyming structure. Doing the brain bottle openers in this book will help you create and sustain goals that are specific, present, and true. By following this step-by-step practical guide, you will learn to silence Marv, let out your big muse, and truly begin the process of seeing your dreams materialize. Now think back once more to that white chalk on that black wall that I mentioned in the introduction to this book. Think about the dream that first arose in your mind when I asked you what you wanted to accomplish with your life before you die. See if you feel different now that you've been equipped with these tools and this new understanding. Before I go, I want to leave you with this quote from the Scottish writer and mountaineer William H. Murray. Whatever you can do, or dream you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Begin it now. We all have the capacity to feel a measure of that genius, power, and magic. They are ours when we take action. The degree to which we commit ourselves to our dreams for our own betterment and for the betterment of the world is the degree to which William H. Murray's words will ring true. As he says, begin it now. This has been a Highbridge production, read by Peter Himmelman. Copyright 2016 by Peter Himmelman. Recorded by arrangement with Tarcher, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC. Recording copyright 2016 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.